Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Here's your hosts, Jazz and David.
G'day everyone, welcome back to another episode of Spark Your Fire. I'm your host, David Shee, and as always, we got our fantastic co-host, Jazz, pumped and excited for another special guest today. Jazz, how are you doing in Melbourne?
I am really good, David. How are you?
Good, really good. Welcome back. Welcome back, as always. I think, it's been over a year, and I can't believe it's been over a year that we've been running this podcast for a while. And I have to say, we had all sorts of walks in life in coming onto the show, and it's just fascinating. I mean, even just be able to explore into people's journey, why they started property and all that kind of stuff. And I have to say, everyone is different, right?
Well, I got to agree on one thing. We have learned probably a lot more over the last year doing this podcast.
That's right.
Than what we knew when we started. So it's a learning exercise, even though we are professionals in the space, but still it's always a learning exercise. Doesn't matter how much you know.
That's right.
Mm. And today's guest is even interesting when you introduce him, because he's been there for, 32 years now, I think.
I know. It's when you put a three in front of it, I think it totally sounds totally different, right?
it sounds pretty old.
No, necessarily. It's called experience, mate. It's called experience. And when you think about we're always on the learning path, and what better way to learn from an actual educator and mentor from our guest today. So I thought it would be a good leeway to introduce him today. We have Rob Flux as a property developer, educator, a mentor, and a public speaker on all things property and property development. Rob, welcome on the show.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Jazz. Hello, audience.
It's always good to have you on the board. And as Jazz mentioned, having a 30 plus years of experience in the property certainly has put a lot of expectations on our audiences today, I should say. So.
That was broken up in two distinct phases, which I'm sure we'll flesh out through the call, but a buy and hold phase and then the property development phase. So have enough experience on both sides of the fence to be able to resonate with most of your listeners, I hope.
I think that's awesome, because I reckon a lot of them obviously is looking at the buy and hold phase, given the fact that most of our audiences are just starting out, and the fact that you've actually gone through both buy and hold and also adding value as a second part of the equation will be able to shed some light in terms of at different stages and why you change lane, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Feel free to interrogate away, Jess.
He's prepared.
I like the word interrogate. Let's start with the interesting part, Rob. How did you got started? I mean, 32 years experience, like every other investor, I wish I started early as well. But tell us how you got started in this space, mate. Let's go back in time.
So if I go way back in time, I grew up in a place called Darwin. And for anyone who knows anything about Darwin, Cyclone Tracy was, the big hit of the 1970s. Mum and Dad lived up there in their home, and Cyclone Tracy blew away their home after only being 8 months old, and pretty much financially devastated them and knocked them out of the game. I saw them going through a great deal of struggle in the early days, not being able to afford the home because that original house was not insured. And so when they went to recreate, they were financially really struggling. And so as a kid, I grew up with not much at all. And I swore black and blue that was never going to happen to me. In order for me to start out on doing what I wanted to do, I actually bought my first house at the age of 18, very much with the intention of trying to, break away from what had happened to me prior. And it was a funny situation where Mum and Dad really wanted to help me, but because they were financially broke, they didn't know how. And so we came up with a very, very creative strategy, and that was that I would actually buy the house off of them, that they would stay there and pay me rent. So I effectively became the landlord for my parents, and Mum and Dad would pay me rent, still do the cooking and the cleaning and all those sorts of things. And then I lived the high life as a typical teenager.
Wow, that's the other way around it. it's I've never heard that before. So parents being the tenants at the age of 18 for the kid.
There's some funny buy stories that'll come from that. I guess for anyone who gets to know me, but that it's certainly unusual.
Right. So this was in Darwin, by the way, right?
Correct.
Is it fair to say the investment journey started from Darwin?
Correct. Yeah. So from that point, set myself up relatively well. But the challenge that I had back then, I guess I was only a second year apprentice when I bought that house. And we came into the recession that we had to have, and interest rates went up to 17 and 18%. And it got to a point where I was struggling financially there, but at the same time, took on an investment journey at the exact same time. And I actually bought my first investment property at the age of 21. After reading a book by a lady by the name of Jan Summers, who was one of the first educators in that property space. Jan educated on buy and hold negative gearing. And so that's what I did because it's the only thing I knew. So first investment property at 21. The market was quite fortunate for me at that point in time. And about 18 months after I bought that property, it had nearly doubled in value. I happened to time the market perfectly. Not through any of my own skills, but through sheer luck. I guess I've learned some of those skills over time and how to pick the market, but in the early days, I didn't have a clue. And so I was fortunate enough in reselling that property a little bit later on that I was able to pay my first home outright, the one I bought at the age of 18, at the age of 24. So I was on a fairly fast trajectory fairly early on.
Wow. See, wow, this is fascinating, right? This doesn't happen anymore. You said the interest rate of 17 to 18%.
Correct.
Now that you look back, I mean, today's interest rate is about 3-4%, under 3% you can get in the market. How do you feel the market in the current environment when you look at when you've seen the whole journey of the rates were that high, 17-18%, and now they're sitting at the rock bottom? How do you look at the market? Purely from an investment perspective, not development, leave the development part aside, just purely from an investment perspective.
Yeah, I guess, and you touched on it, because I've got the investment side and the development side, I kind of wear two hats. And so for me, I do the manufacturing of my wealth through the property development, and then I hold my profits as long-term buy and hold assets rather than so I manufacture them at wholesale price rather than buying them at retail price. So for me, I look at the long-term investment view very, very differently, because to me, I'm really looking at the passive cash flow that comes from it. And I don't really care that much about the capital growth side of it. It's a bonus rather than being, I guess, the primary driver. Cash flow is really the thing that makes us financially wealthy. And capital growth is just the vehicle to get us to the point of cash flow faster.
Tell me if I've understood it wrong, but you're saying that the capital growth is going to lack now a little bit? It's more of the cash flow game in the future?
For where I'm at in my journey, the capital growth is less important.
Right. Okay.
So the capital growth happens as a byproduct now rather than being my primary driver. So early on, it was my primary driver, but nowadays it's not. So cash flow is my primary driver now, and the capital growth is a byproduct of owning the property. And so I don't really care as much if the market goes up and down, because I'm positively geared enough that it doesn't really impact my serviceability on owning the asset, because I had enough equity built in through that property development phase. And it's always positively geared, so I don't do negative gearing at all anymore, and would highly recommend people to reconsider negative gearing as an approach, because it is very much a handbrake I learned in your growth trajectory.
For investors who are starting out in this space, who are trying to build their investment portfolio, what would you recommend them in today's market? Is it more go for balanced approach, try and still hit capital growth like you did when you got started, or it's really the cash flow game now, based on today's market.
I think there's two very distinct kinds of investors. So rather than giving one set of advice and saying that's going to be perfect for everyone, there's passive investors who don't have the time, effort, or skills in order to force value onto the property. And so they will take a very passive approach and purchase a property that they hold onto and just let the market do the heavy lifting. And then there's active investors who, I guess, do have the time, and they use that time to actually learn the skills and force value onto the property through their own knowledge and skills and sweat equity. So two very different kind of investor. So from a passive investor point of view, I would say I would very highly encourage to never do a negative gearing type approach. Always go for some form of positively geared or at minimum neutral, so that if the market goes up and down, you've at least got your debt coverage in order, and you're not getting yourself in a position where you're at the mercy of the banks for margin calls and things like that should the market go against you. So that's for the passive investor. For the active investor, I would say the opportunities are abundant if you learn to understand supply and demand of the market and where the market is actually going. And if you can actually manufacture your growth through that property development process, then you can keep your profits where you've manufactured the profit in it. And if you don't cash that in, then you're not effectively realizing your profit. And if you're not realizing your profit, you have effectively gone into a deferred tax arrangement where you can keep 100% of that profit in the deal for as long as you own the property, which means 100% of your profit grows with that long-term buy and hold rather than a percentage of that if you sell down.
Right, okay. So now that's a good way to look at it, obviously passive and active, and depending upon which category do you fall in, right? But without getting distracted too much, so that was your first property that you bought, the first investment property that you bought, and within 4 years or 3 years probably, you were able to pay off by selling that property, correct?
It was actually 6 years. So at the age of 24, I owned that home outright.
6 years. So you sold that property to pay off your house. Or did he release
the- Yeah, correct. So I had a couple of investment properties at the time, sold one of them down, paid down, I guess, a significant portion of the debt. And because of the fact that I went in as a second year apprentice, my wage went up at the same time, third year, fourth year tradesman, et cetera. So I was able to use that to massively pay down the balance of the debt as well. And I guess the two combined worked really well for me.
Right. Okay. And what happened after that? So that's 6 years over there we have talked about.
So I kept doing the buy and hold negative gearing. I actually did that for approximately 20 years. And mathematically, I was in a situation where at the age of 38, I could retire. And unfortunately, with enough passive income to be quite comfortable. But unfortunately, at the age of 37, I got divorced. And so what I guess was 20 years of investment suddenly disappeared very quickly, and I got myself in a position where I had to start again. And in starting again, I didn't want to wait 20 years to do it the second time round, and so that's where I started my journey into the property development side of things, where I could force that value onto the property through my own knowledge and experience.
At the age of 38, what was your portfolio size by then?
Yeah, well, I want to make that really clear, guys, that the size of your portfolio has no reflection at all on your wealth. True wealth comes from passive income, and if you are doing well, you don't need to own many properties to have enough passive income. So when people go, how many properties did you have? I'm quite comfortable to say that I was in the one percentile of Australia, and I don't know the exact number. It was probably 7 or 8 properties at that point in time, but I guess it's how positively geared they are. But by comparison, I've got 3 properties right now that generate 210K worth of income. So it's not how many you own, it's what they are and how good they are and where they're located.
No, that's a really good point, actually. It's not the number of properties, it's the income or the capital growth or the total dollar value that's attached to it that matters a bit. So the reason, the trigger for getting into the property development, you already mentioned, is partly you got divorced and you decided not to start from the scratch again and then make it try and fast track things a little bit. And that was through the property development. I guess by that time you had enough experience with the buy and hold strategy and obviously looking at some developments, I guess, that you went into that space.
Yeah, so I had done some value adding through that buy and hold phase, through largely through, I guess, renovations to increase yields and things like that. And so I could see that forcing value onto it, onto the property, helped massively, both from a valuation perspective and also from a rental yield perspective. And so I said, well, rather than just doing renovation, there's all these other development strategies out there. Let's see what I can do to actually, I guess, accelerate that very fast. And I went and paid for a number of coaches, a number of mentors, did a lot of courses in that property development space, some of which were good, some of which were very much spruikers. I think the cheapest course that I paid for was about 25K and the most expensive was about 40K. Wow. All trying to, I guess, fast track my knowledge. And I guess what I found in that process is that there's a lot of really good educators out there, but there's also some common challenges in most of those courses that sit out there, no matter what price point you're paying. And those common challenges are that they're generally very aspirational, in that they motivate you to do something, but they're not very detailed oriented, and I'm a very details oriented kind of person. And the second thing is, when you're paying for the mentoring side of things, the advice that you tended to get was very generic in nature and didn't really cater for the very specific scenarios that you might have on your particular property. And as a byproduct of that, whilst I was learning from those guys, I went, well, I'm not quite getting what I need out of this journey. And I got a bunch of mates sit around my kitchen table. We had five mates originally sitting around my kitchen table, and we decided that none of us knew everything, but collectively we knew quite a bit, and we started helping each other's projects move forward. And we used a masterminding technique out of a book by a gentleman by the name of Napoleon Hill, and that book is called Think and Grow Rich. And we used that technique to try and advance our projects and get successes in that. That worked extraordinarily well. And what I found is that as I started to get success, each mate would kind of invite a mate and they would invite another mate. And all of a sudden we found that we were running a public networking group which is now called Property Developer Network. And that has now turned into the largest networking group of its kind in Australia, with just short of 8,000 members in it. And we have monthly networking groups in Brisbane, Sydney, and Melbourne, where we still continue that little masterminding technique to this day. That's now become a very large passion of mine in running that network and paying it forward and helping others to kickstart their goals.
Right. While we are on it, what is the group about essentially? So obviously you guys got started because you were looking at the property development space. Is the group purely educational thing for like-minded people, or you actually discuss the real investment opportunities that are there on the table? What is the group about?
Yeah, good question. So it's a support network for any up-and-coming novice developer. So whether you have no experience at all or whether or not you've got some experience, we've got a wide range of people with different levels in that group. But the whole idea is to say, what can we give you from a knowledge perspective each and every month that's going to help you to progress your projects? So we always have an industry expert every single month come in and talk about different issues and challenges that exist in the industry. So we have town planners, civil engineers, architects, property lawyers, accountants, and the like. We always have one of those industry experts every month. And we also have somebody from within the community share what we call a real deal, which is, I guess, the good, the bad, and the ugly of a project. So, you know, it's not just the profits that were made, but it was also, I guess, the lumps and bumps of the journey along the way to get there, so that people can see that things are achievable, but in the end, property developers are problem solvers, and so we expose them to the problems and we show them that they're actually solvable, and that's kind of how that works. And then we then recreate that kitchen table experience and break up into small masterminding groups and keep paying it forward and helping others to progress their projects.
Right. Okay. So it's basically more of build your network, try and see people that resonate with you and see where it takes from there kind of thing. And yeah, plus discuss some of the real scenarios, obviously.
Yeah. So it's a tribe of sorts of like-minded people that are all going on the same journey, that are all supportive of each other. And we have, enough educational elements in that you will always learn something every single meeting that you turn up. And that includes me having done this for 32 odd years. I still learn every single day. And the more I learn, the more I realize that there's more to learn.
Right. How many property development projects have you done yourself, Rob, by now?
I haven't counted, but it's probably approaching 20. I'd have to go back and do an actual count, but it's in that vicinity. It's a ever-evolving thing. Right now I'm running 3 projects at a time and managing to do that while flying around the country and helping others do it as well.
Right, okay. And these projects are normally smaller kind of subdivisions, 1 into 2, or they are more bigger, much, much bigger projects than that? What are we talking about?
What I teach our guys is what is called the missing middle, which is infill developments, which are small cookie cutter size projects that are bite-sized enough to be quite attractive in the profits that they make. But they're too small for the big developers to want to take on, because the big developers have got very large overheads and they need very large profits to be worthwhile. So we're looking at these smaller infill developments that have a massive opportunity across Australia, where people want to still live in the same community that they grew up in. But as they downsize, they want to, get rid of that big backyard that they were having, struggling to maintain as they get older. And the young upwardly mobile want to live in the same areas as well. So there's lots of these infill developments opportunities all around Australia.
So did I get that right? It's more of backyard subdivisions?
No, it's not just backyard subdivisions. So subdivisions, townhouses, unit complexes, but typically I'm going to say a 10 pack and below.
How do you work out the numbers? I mean, whether the project is feasible or not, is there a minimum GP you guys look at, gross profit that it has to hit, or how do you guys go about that?
I will answer that, but I'm going to have a slight tangent and then come back to that, because there's a lot of misnomers in the industry as to what those profit margins should be. And so allow me to digress and then I'll come back and answer that question and it'll all kind of make sense.
Sure.
Every different development strategy has different timelines, different risks, different issues and challenges. So there are some development strategies that you can complete in 3 months, and there are some development strategies that will take you 3 years. And so when you're comparing a project against each other, and when somebody says, hey, what's your profit margin, people tend to forget that time is a valuable measure of these the success of a project. And typically the margins that people throw around are a 20% profit on cost, but they're talking about projects that are taking 2 or 2.5 years to run. So when you throw that time element into that, we're talking at somewhere between 8 and 10% annualized return for some of these really big projects that that people are taking on. So if you then compare that against a project that might take 3 months or 6 months, it's really easy to beat that 10% annualized return. And so if I've got a project that, for example, gets an 8 or 9% profit and it's only going to take six months to run, that we're talking about a 16 to 18% annualized return. And so it's really important that we actually compare, a like for like when we're talking about profit margins. We run a couple of courses to try and teach people which development strategy is going to suit them, because some people prefer subdivisions. Some people prefer townhouses and units, and each one of them takes a different timeline. Each one have different issues and challenges in trying to solve. And depending upon your personal circumstances, you're not going to be able to physically be able to do all of the different strategies out there. So we get them to pick a single strategy to lock that down and then follow that strategy to its natural end and build a five-year roadmap of projects that are going to build on the success of project number one and then accelerate that. So one person who picks a townhouse strategy might do a two-lot subdivision first, and then they'll do a four-lot, then they'll do a six-lot, and then they'll do an eight-lot. Whereas someone who does a townhouse strategy, they'll probably do, one into two, then a one into four, then et cetera. They'll grow that way. So we get them to stick to one strategy and move from there. So typically the subdivision strategies are 12 months and less until you get quite large. And typically a townhouse project is somewhere in the 2 to 2.5 year timeline.
And so with these courses that you run to teach people on the development side, are there different plans that you have got that suits different people, or it's just a standard plan packages that you have on those?
So we start with getting them to lock in their development strategy. And we don't teach every development strategy out there, so I'm very clear in that side of things. And once people have locked in what is their development strategy, if it happens to not be us, that's great. That's actually a fantastic outcome, because now they know they can go to the right educator and get the right outcome. The thing that has always bothered me in this industry is that a spruiker will stand at the front of the stage and tell you how fantastic their strategy is, and a lot of people buy the course, and the course is great content, but if it doesn't suit your particular financial circumstances, then it's not going to be relevant to you. You're not going to be able to execute it. And so there's a lot of people who buy courses that just wasted. And yet the person sitting right beside them, they are financially resourced in order to do that. And so that the exact same course with the exact same content has a fantastic outcome for them. So it's not the course. It's really whether or not somebody has taken the time to work out what is their development strategy first. And I think that's the difference between us and the other guys, is we get them to lock in their strategy. I teach subdivisions, units and townhouses, but there are other people who teach a whole bunch of other different strategies. You know, you've got renovation courses, you've got cash flow courses, you've got NDIS, you've got rooming accom. I don't specialize in all of those. I just stick within my lane.
Devil's advocate, how can you lock in a strategy when you're not even experienced and you're trying to figure out what's going to work for you or not, right? So
it's actually quite simple. And the biggest problem I see in the entire industry, and with 8,000 people in our community have seen this quite a lot, is that people don't know how to pick their strategy and they flip-flop between them and they become jack of all trades and master of none. And so what we built is a mechanism which is a very complex matrix of things like, what is your risk profile? What is your cash flow situation? How much equity do you have from a purchasing power perspective? How much cash flow you've got to actually pay your consultants along the way? And we plug all of those different elements into this matrix. And what pops out are the two or three strategies that suit your current circumstances. And when you understand that those particular constraints are sitting there, you don't get distracted then from the bright, shiny objects where other people are doing something bigger that you're attracted to but physically just can't execute.
So the course takes you into the real-life scenario where you actually will pick a deal and try and work it out based on whatever strategy you take, or it's more of all theory?
No, so it's very practical. So we actually have you in a classroom with laptops actually analyzing real sites in real time. So it's a very hands-on how-to. But I think your question is more in the choosing your strategy side of things. And that is, I guess, we start by going back and getting people to actually do a budget, do their assets and liabilities, actually understand their current situation, then understand what their future goals are. And we try to help them not only pick a development strategy, but also build a five-year roadmap for How do they actually genuinely start to scale their projects from small to medium to large so they can actually get to financially free, which is, I guess, the goal that all of us are aiming for. We do provide a platform where people trade deals and seek investors that is really just a trading room of sorts, but we don't take any, we don't sit in the middle of that. We just kind of let the market do its thing.
So you're essentially just basically providing the platform
correct.
For them. Okay, that makes sense.
It's a platform for people to trade off-market deals and seek investors. And we don't sit in there as a middle player. We just provide the platform for them to do those trades themselves.
Gotcha. Okay. Can I just ask, when you were shifting from your first part of the investment strategy to the second part, which is when you become from a passive investor to an active investor, what was the process that you had to go through in between? So I know you've gone through the divorce. Did you have to sell off pretty much all your portfolio, first of all, to settle the divorce deal, and then you had to start from scratch again, so building up from zero, moving into a passionate,
So pretty much sold all the assets down with the exception of the principal place of residence, and at the age of 38, I no longer even owned the principal place of residence. So, you know, when you had owned it at the age of 24 and you're now at 38 and don't, that takes a little bit of a sting to the pride. But had to reload and go again. It was a difficult time emotionally for me to try and overcome that. And it was about 18 months where I wallowed in my own self-pity, to be brutally honest, before I actually picked up my socks and started to go again.
Yeah, before you can bounce back, essentially. But what was the epiphany moment in terms of changing lane? So obviously the buy and hold, wait for growth, has worked out well for you for the last, from what, the age of 18 to about 38, so 20 years, say. But you realize, or something must have triggered that point in time to go, you know, this is not working out for me for the next 20 years, for example. What was the epiphany moment?
So and great question, because most people don't ask that. At the time, I guess just before we were going, just before we divorced, at the time we were putting plans in place to actually build our dream home. So this is kind of a, 1K from the city with 270-degree views of the city and the mountains and all sorts of things like that. When I lost that dream, it happened to be very close to where I transited from home to work every single day. And so I made it a point of mine every single day to deviate and go past that property. And every day I would look at it and go, that is my motivator and my driving force to, that is going to be mine and I'm going to have that again. You know, some people do affirmations and some people do visualizations, but for me, that was my physical visualization to drive past that every day for 6 months to get me to lift again.
Right. Okay. But in terms of, I mean, you know, you could have accumulated at that point in time, could have accumulated another 7 or 8 properties again and just wait for it to grow for the next 20 years. But instead, you've chosen to take the active path of, you know, and I think that's at the point in time where you actually says, you know what, I don't think it's the capital growth that's going to take me to my freedom. It's actually the cash flow that's going to take me to the freedom for the next 20 years. So that was obviously a big change in terms of the mindset. And I think a lot of people didn't realize that as we progress with our age, and moving towards retirement phase, that kind of stuff. It's not the capital growth. It is absolutely the cash flow that's going to be able to support you. And I guess my point at that time being, you know, when, say, taking 38 years old as the actual split between stage one and stage two, you've obviously moved from a passive investor to an active investor after 38, but you've also changed from a capital growth play into a cash flow play. Now, what was the change in that mindset?
So that came from reading a book that a lot of your viewers probably would have read. That was Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And it was really, really getting to realize that this is really a business, and that cash flow is the most important part of that. Now, Robert is, I guess, based in another country. Some of his teachings don't apply directly here, but there was enough of that, the epiphany in reading that book that went, okay, I need to actually get to a point where the cash flow is the critical element. Mm. And the capital growth is really just the way of accumulating enough properties fast to make the cash flow happen sooner. And so he doesn't talk about property development because he's a buy and hold investor himself. But it was me going, well, I've added capital growth in the past, and I've forced value onto properties myself through minor renovations and things like that. And it was me just joining the dots on those to say, well, if I force value onto it, then I can uplift the yields very, very quickly, very, very fast, pull my capital back out, reload and go again, keeping that positive cash flow asset in there. Mm. So it was really combining the previous 20 years with reading that book and putting the two together.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great book. And it all talks about the cash flow quadrant, isn't it? So, you know, having that passive income coming in, I think that's definitely a revolutionary concept at that time. And I'm sure it still absolutely. Is today.
And worthy of saying to your viewers that the definition of financial freedom is very, very poorly misunderstood. And it's largely because there's a whole bunch of spruikers out there that promises a whole bunch of dreams for get rich quick schemes. So it's not the mansion, it's not the fancy boat, it's not all the toys. But financial freedom is enough passive income to pay down your debts. That's as complicated as it gets. Now, the less debts you have, the easier it is to actually become financially free, which means that ironically, the less income you have, then the more meager the lifestyle you have. So the less debts you have, the easier it is to actually achieve. And it's actually reverse of what most people think. What tends to happen is as you start to earn more and more in your day job, you tend to buy bigger and bigger toys and bigger houses, and you increase your debt levels. And so then you get stuck on the treadmill and can't get out. But the people that have lived very meager lifestyles, they're actually very easy for them to get out.
When you say debts, clear of the debts, Rob, you mean good debts or bad debts or both debts? I mean, obviously bad debts, yes, but any debt, right? So including investment debt, basically.
Well, so it's only a good debt if it's actually earning you an income.
Yeah, so back to the cash flow.
Back to the cash flow. So, Robert Kiyosaki says that that your principal place of residence is actually bad debt because it's not actually earning you an income. Now, I tend to agree with him from a financial perspective, but there's a difference between, having financial goals and also having personal and lifestyle goals. And so we tend to still want to principal place of residence just because we want to keep our spouse happy and we want to have somewhere for the kids to grow up. So it's a balance between how do I grow financially and how do I grow emotionally.
Right. But I can honestly continue. There's a lot more I can talk. I love property, so I can continue, but I'm being cautious of time. David, are there any other specific questions that we want to cover?
Yeah, no, I think that's wrap up for this one.
All right. So just Rob, quickly, what are the three tips that you will give to investors who are starting out in this space in the current market environment where the interest rates are so low? How to best go about building the property portfolio?
So I would say that doesn't matter if you're an investor or a developer, the same principles apply. So the first thing is get very, very clear on your strategy. And when you become very clear on your strategy, you'll get very good at understanding the drivers, the market drivers, the rules that they operate under, different council legislations, et cetera. You get very, very good at that one strategy, which means that you'll be able to execute that one strategy well. Don't be tempted to have a look at multiple strategies and deviate from the path, because you'll become jack of all trades and master of none. I prefer to be inch wide and mile deep on one strategy, get to do it very well, and you'll become very successful at it. So that's tip number one. Tip number two is, based on your strategy, then choose the areas where your strategy works. Because every strategy works, but it doesn't work everywhere. And once you are good at understanding what the drivers are for your strategy, then you'll know what areas your strategy is actually going to work in. So you'll determine whether or not that's capital cities, whether that's regional cities. You'll determine whether or not that's particular councils within that capital city. You'll determine the suburbs within that council within that city. You'll start to look at your state government's strategic direction as to how and where populations are going to go, and you look at the demand, supply and demand of different products in the area, and you'll know exactly where to actually start to do that for your strategy. So that's kind of tip number two. And then tip number three is, now that you know your strategy and now that you know the area, you can now build your team that sits around that, because they're going to be an expert in your strategy and an expert in your area. And your team is going to be very much based on, I guess, the combination of those two, because it's great to have the best town planner on earth, but it's no good if he's not an expert in your particular council. So that's kind of the first three steps that we teach in our 9-step program is those three. And if you get that right, then everything else flows on from that.
There's some good tips over there. That's awesome. That's good, Rob. Just changing gears a little bit, moving away from property into some more interesting stuff. Quick questions. Aliens, believe it or not?
Absolutely. Like, what's not to believe? There's a gazillion planets out there. There's got to be one of them that's habitable.
David, you there? He doesn't believe.
we had all sort of mixed responses. So
yeah. That's true. Crypto, here to stay or a fad?
Here to stay, but still a fad.
Here to stay, but still a fad. That's interesting. What do you mean by that?
Well, the technology is here to stay forever. But all the hype that sat behind it has, I guess, come and gone. It will have a slow and steady growth over time. The technology is not going to go anywhere. It will become an intrinsic part of our lifestyle. What I didn't say in my journey is I spent 20 years in IT, so I'm quite savvy from a crypto side of things. So the technology is starting to permeate our natural world without people even realizing. So the way they're actually doing property transactions and settlements and things like that is using a lot of that blockchain technology nowadays. So the technology is here to stay, but the hype behind, I guess, the individual cryptos, because there's so many of them, they just don't have the legs. It will just become one of those blasé things like your smartphone that it was fancy when the first iPhone came out, and nowadays it's just expected.
Fair enough. AI, do you think AI will take over humanity?
Do I think it'll take over?
In our lifetime, in the next 20, 30, 40 years.
If we're talking Terminator side of things and if Skynet's going to come, then I don't think Skynet's coming. But I do think that AI is going to become an intrinsic part of everything that we do and a lot of the things that we do from an automation perspective. It is already a massive part in what we do daily without most people realizing that. And I'm working on some technologies in the back end using my IT brain and my property brain together to try and, I guess, leverage that to create some really fancy stuff that we hope to be announcing in about 6 months' time. So watch this space, folks.
But when I ask the question, I mean that actually humans will be controlled by AI. Will that happen in the future?
I think there are elements of what we're doing that probably are already without us realizing. So a lot of the cloud services that you operate, a lot of the when you're doing simple things like watching Netflix and it recommends the next show to watch, it's because AI has made a whole bunch of interpretations on that. When you go to your Amazon account, the products that it recommends is all AI based. What Facebook sticks in front of you is all AI based. It is already inherently part of what we are doing daily, and we just don't realize it. And the technology will just become so entrenched in what we do that we just forget that it's there.
Yeah, fair enough. That's great. Rob, it was great to have you on the show. There's definitely a plethora of experience over here that listeners will learn from, and there's a lot more stuff we do want to dig a bit more into the actual developments that we are probably doing, and we'll discuss about how we can bring you back on the show for that. But thanks for coming on the show today, and to our listeners, hope you guys are enjoying the content. If you are, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating and let the word spread like fire. Spark your fire. Cheers, Jazz and David. Bye.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.